Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Gustave Caillebotte was among the most critically noted Impressionist artists during the height of their activity in the late 1870s and early 1880s. The exhibition, Gustave Caillebotte, The Painter's Eye, on view at the National Gallery of Art from June 28th through October 4th, 2015, brings together some 55 of his most successful paintings, primarily from the brief period, 1875 to 1882, when he was fully engaged with the Impressionist movement. In this opening day lecture, Mary Morton explores the provocative character and complexity of Caillebotte's contributions, which range from spectacular images of the new public spaces designed by Baron Haussmann to visual meditations on leisure time activities in and around Paris.
Thank you very much, and welcome this afternoon on this gorgeous Sunday. I didn't think anyone would come after being trapped inside all day yesterday during the deluge. But I'm glad that you've come. We're going to have a nice sort of hour together, and we're going to try and figure out what's going on in the galleries upstairs. And I wanted to start with the question of who is this guy, Gustave Caillebotte? Over the several years that I've been working on this project, I get either a blank stare at the naming of our artist, or alternatively, I get, I love Caillebotte, but the fan can't name more than one or two works by the artist, if any. Indeed, two of his works are fairly well known. The Floor Scrapers, which hangs at the Musée d'Orsay and has been on view in French public museums for over a century, and has been cited recently in advertisements on not one, but two floor finishing company vans on the Ventura Freeway in Los Angeles. This is a photo that I took actually a couple of summers ago, driving 75 miles an hour on the Ventura Freeway. I handed my iPhone to my friend David and he snapped this, but I think it came out rather clearly. And then, of course, Paris Street Rainy Day, the umbrella painting, which emerged from a private collection in 1954 when it was acquired by Walter Chrysler. And it toured the country and then with his collection. And then in 1964 was acquired by the Art Institute of Chicago, where it remains their iconic painting. It's the kind of painting that, once seen in person, imprints itself on the mind, even if the name of the maker does not. And I'm just showing you one of the terminal signs at Charles de Gaulle. And then our very own local, thanks to my husband for taking this snap this morning, this is the mural at the Bistro Le Pic in Upper Georgetown, and it hangs at the end. Each of these pictures caused a sensation when exhibited at the second and third Impressionist exhibitions in 1876 and 77, respectively. Some critics heralded Caillebotte as the leader of the movement, and indeed he was at the heart of five of the eight Impressionist exhibitions, organizing, helping to fund, and exhibiting dozens of paintings, some 70 by his last showing with them in 1882. Why don't we know more about him? Why is his name not as familiar as that of Monet and Renoir and Degas and Pizarro? So this afternoon, in addition to introducing you to the best of Caillebotte's oeuvre, most of which you will find upstairs in the exhibition, and accounting for its singular achievement and impact, I would also like to try and provide some answers to these questions, which have to do with the way that art history, and more specifically art historiography, or the writing of art history, is made. But let's get now right into the exhibition. Roughly a decade younger than the other Impressionists, Caillebotte had grown up in the capital city during a period of radical, violent renovation. He spent his youth in the first arrondissement, and then when his father sold his company, he supplied cots to the French army, they moved into a brand new townhome in the 8th arrondissement, one of the new neighborhoods that had been planned by Napoleon III and his prefect, Baron Haussmann, in their massive urban renewal project during the Second Empire, in which Paris was remade from essentially a medieval city into the modern metropolis that we recognize today, the grand, broad boulevards piercing their way through the city, the uniform architecture, the parks and places, transforming the capital city over the course of two decades or more. In the second Impressionist exhibition in 1876, his first public exhibition, Caillebotte presented an image of what must have been a fairly common occurrence: workers preparing the floors of one of the uniformly designed Haussmannian buildings that proliferated at the heart of the urban plan. The floor scrapers is literally an insider's view, most likely inspired by a similar event in the Caillebotte family home on the Rue de Miromesnil. In the half light of sun reflecting off adjacent buildings through this high floor window, lean laborers stripped to the waist rhythmically plane the floor. The floor tilts up, projecting the workers forward toward the viewer's space. Their muscled arms, not their indistinct faces, gain our attention. The painting was received as a realist provocation in the tradition of Gustave Courbet's Stonebreakers. One critic wrote, quote, "Everyone who's known the pleasure or boredom of construction knows the way these robust fellows work, who remove clothing that gets in the way, keeping on only the most indispensable garments, thus offering the studious artist a nude, a torso, and a bust that other workers do not expose so freely." So, referencing the tradition of the academic male nude, Caillebotte then debunks it by producing modern, unidealized male bodies associated with the labor of contemporary urban construction. Visitors to the third Impressionist exhibition entered off the newly laid Boulevard Haussmann into a freshly constructed apartment building whose plaster walls were still wet, and found a triptych of large-scale, precisely rendered images of the surrounding arrondissement. Ambitious in scale, Paris Street Rainy Day, the house painters on the lower right, and the Pont de l'Europe on the lower left were carefully planned for maximum visual impact. They established an indelible link between Caillebotte and the effects of Baron Haussmann's radical changes to the city. Where the art of Manet and Degas made oblique references to the psychological effects of what was called Haussmannization, and Monet, Renoir, and Pizarro occasionally used views of the new parts of the city in their aesthetic constructions of light and color and touch, Caillebotte's work responded directly to the new Paris and its network of vast boulevards and adjacent residential neighborhoods. The epically scaled Paris Street Rainy Day was immediately recognized as the exhibition's masterpiece. Calculated to aggressively absorb the viewer, the painting was an experiential tour de force in which the large-scale perspectival distortions, figural placement, and compositional cropping conspire to transport the viewer to a recently completed corner of the new Paris. The new crossroads had been constructed at a late stage of Haussmann's project. Built during Caillebotte's youth, it was a short walk from his family home near the Boulevard Malesherbes in the redesigned Quartier de l'Europe. No sign of the previous site remains visible in this picture. Every inch has been overlaid by new paving and architecture and ornamented by the ubiquitous street lamps belonging to the fixed design class known as street furniture. Caillebotte showed this location stripped of the human patina of history, punctuated by the monotonous uniformity of mass-produced umbrellas and figures sheathed in the self-effacing bourgeois male costume of a top hat and black redingote. The central female figure wears consciously understated street couture, minimally embellished with earrings and a fur-trimmed coat. And we can read her outfit a little bit better now that the painting has been cleaned. The Art Institute of Chicago recently completed a cleaning project on this picture. It had not been touched in decades. Everyone was afraid to touch it, everybody in the conservation studio. It's such an iconic picture for the institution. It's like the Mona Lisa of the Art Institute of Chicago. So everybody was afraid until Faye Rubel, who's been there for decades, got up the courage, had lived with this picture forever, and she took it on about a year ago. And it's not radically transformed, but I would say that the sense of luminosity In fact, the sense of wetness that, you know, the rain has just sort of stopped and you have that very particular effect of light is much more palpable. So it's thrilling, obviously. This is its debut outside of Chicago. The second in Kaibat's trilogy of boulevard views is the smaller scale House Painters, picturing a similarly monochromatic scene in which the street recedes into the distance even more dramatically. In the foreground, you see a group of painters who are decorating the facade of what looks like possibly a wine shop. It's a charming vignette. One man fiddles with his pipe while his partners perch on ladders, brushes in hand. Critics were relieved to engage with the painting they perceived as even more anecdotal, called Pont de l'Europe. The location would have been immediately recognizable as the cast iron bridge that spanned the train yards of the busiest station in the city, the Gare Saint-Lazare. It was completed in 1868, this engineering feat, and it accommodated six crisscrossing boulevards and an open place over the railroad tracks. And just to read it, you see the bridge coming down here, and then it circles, the place is in the center, and it comes all the way over to the other side to span this gigantic rail yard. On the broad, long sidewalk of this new space, several characters are in play, but the viewer's attention focuses on a well-dressed man at the center in the middle ground. Although in an earlier preparatory sketch, Kaibat placed the well-dressed man and the woman walking side by side as a couple, the final work shows the gentleman skewed forward so that his gaze is directed intently at a third figure, the young worker leaning at the railing on the right. This youth stands casually, his feet crossed, his hand oddly clenched at his cheek, his face slightly flushed. An older man in a green work smock passes farther down the sidewalk, his hand dropped limply to his side. Several other single men stand at the railing, their backs to the street and passers-by, apparently watching the activity of the station below. And then you see in the far distance a lone soldier crossing the street. The traditional narrative of this picture focuses on the male and female strolling at the left, as T.J. Clark read them in his 1984 account, quote, "the bourgeois engaged in a mysterious transaction with a woman, his wife, his mistress, a passerby, a prostitute, who knows?" The suggestion of prostitution is relevant, particularly since the new boulevards, as open public spaces designed for walking, proved ideal for soliciting sex. Indeed, a conspicuous sexual commerce in the streets had become, in one scholar's words, the new trademark of modern city life in the Paris of the 1870s and early 1880s. The female prostitute was the topos of modern life, featured in the work of such avant-garde writers as Huysmans and Maupassant and Zola, and more elliptically in the works presented to the public by such artists as Manet and Degas and Renoir. Less often discussed in the literature is the corresponding rise in male prostitution. Just as female courtesans took to the new boulevards to garner new clients, signaling offers through costume and coded behavior, so too did mostly working class men gather along specific routes to sell pleasure to wealthier members of the same sex. The epicenter for this trade was in the 8th and 9th arrondissement, the newest neighborhoods, around the arcades, known as the Passage, on the boulevards, and near train stations. In these crowded places, contact could be made surreptitiously, anonymously, in motion. While homosexuality was not illegal in France, engaging in same-sex behavior in public was illegal, and Parisian vice squads amplified their efforts in the socially conservative years of the early Third Republic. Indeed, in 1876, the year that Pont de l'Europe was painted, several sensational trials involving socially established aristocrats engaged in activities with young working class men in public played out in the press, raising public awareness of the problem. The Kimball version of Pont de l'Europe might be interpreted in light of these realities. In his reading, Kaibat returns to the site and renders the next chapter in the narrative. The top-hatted figure has halted just beyond the man leaning on the railing. He stands very close, but makes no visible contact. He has presumably stopped to look at trains, but his view is blocked by the iron trellis. Perhaps he's listening or speaking softly. The curious emphasis on his hand, hanging limply at his side, echoes the emphasis on hands in the Geneva version. Allusions, it might be imagined, to a mute signal system. Another top-hatted man passes closely, exiting the composition at the left. The anonymity of these figures, pressed into such a tight space, suggests a scene of transgressive, surreptitious contact in a public space perfectly designed for the kind of plein air encounters that are known to have proliferated in the 1870s. There is little context or precedent for any of these street pictures. Jean Barrault's charming scenes are later and more anecdotal. Degas tended towards interiors, with the Place de la Concorde an exception, but even in this case, the artist's intent leans toward portraiture of his friend Henri Lepic and his daughters. There is our own Manet's Railway of 1873, an illuminating comparison with the Kimball Pont de l'Europe that I just showed you. A similarly compressed space, placed just off the bridge along the rail yard. So you see all the way to the right, this is the Pont de l'Europe, and it spans behind here. These are the rail yards of the Gare Saint-Lazare, in which there is an aura of anonymity to the figures, the little girl turning her face away, the young woman staring blankly at the beholder. And here, too, a commercial relationship is insinuated. In this case, a governess and her guard. In this picture, exhibited at the 1880 Impressionist exhibition, Caillebotte presents the iconic New Paris locus for social engagements and entertainment, the glamorous Boulevard Café. Here the painter catalogs the features of such an interior, the wine-red velvet banquettes, white marble tables on iron legs, and gilding on glass bowl sconces, on wall moldings, and on framed plate glass mirrors. A striped awning seen in the mirror's reflection signals the cafe entrance on the boulevard. The mirror is critical to the painting's subtle drama. While revealing more elements of the milieu, it hopelessly complicates and confounds a sense of coherent interior space. Placed off-center in the composition, the man is neatly coiffed, his carefully parted hair revealed beneath a jauntily perched melon-shaped derby. Sporting a long auburn mustache and sideburns, starched collar and kerchief, he is a dapper habitué, recognized as such by contemporary critics. One wrote, quote, "He is a type seized from life who really belongs to our epoch. He is dressed to play in the heart of the shimmering new city, but his skewed gaze suggests psychological absence. His hands in his pockets, he is waiting through the daylight hours for the evening's events to begin." Both Manet and Degas favored the theme of the cafe, although they generally focused on its female figures, performers, servers, and prostitutes. Women frequenting upscale cafes were generally available for hire, and representations of sexually charged exchanges between men and women in cafes, a staple of popular imagery, caricatures and cartoons, became an increasingly common motif for avant-garde as well as more official French painting. Again, Manet is the closest artistic referent in this picture. And here we have the gallery's own Plum Brandy from around the same time. This young woman, similarly dressed up and waiting, cigarette unlit, brandy-soaked plum untouched for something to start, for it all to begin. And then, of course, there's Manet's masterpiece, The Bar at the Folies Bergères, which followed Caillebotte's Manet at the Café by 2 years. But similarly enhances the enigmatic nature of the central figure through mirror play. In this, the only cafe scene that we know by Caillebotte, the artist supplanted the female figure typical of the genre with a male model, a signature provocation in his oeuvre. 2 years later, at the 7th Impressionist exhibition in 1882, Caillebotte submitted an extraordinary range of paintings, including this large-scale genre painting titled Game of Bézique. Bézique, or Bézique, was a popular mid-century game in France involving play between two opponents. So here you see Caillebotte's friends gathered around a table to watch his old friend Maurice Brault on the left, this fellow here, playing his brother, Martial Caillebotte. Spectators of the game include a man named Desaume and another one named Cassebois. The man standing over the table, we think, is Richard Gallo. And sitting on the couch in the back as if exhausted by play is a man named Paul Hugo. We have a wonderful scale portrait of Monsieur Hugo upstairs. None of these men, save Martial some years later, are known to have married or had their own families. The group feels to be tight-knit, gathered together in close proximity, but the men are wholly focused on the game rather than one another. No direct interaction between any two individuals is visible in this hushed scene of cerebral sparring. Brault's shortened upper body is wound up tight like a spring, and his beautifully painted face is radiant, his red lip glistening as he directs a rapt gaze at the moving hand of Martial placing a card. The picture makes a striking counterpoint to Renoir's masterpiece, The Luncheon of the Boating Party, from the Phillips Collection, as you know, across town, which hung near the game of Bézique at the 1882 Impressionist exhibition. The two most remarked upon pictures by contemporary critics, they make a striking pair, similarly large in format. They are each about 4 feet tall by 5 feet wide. Renoir's masterpiece also pictures a group of friends around a table, but the artist wove them together through gesture and gaze, and the painting reeks of flirtatious conviviality. Several critics proclaimed these impressive tableaux as unimpressionist in the ambitious nature of their compositions, clearly plotted out with great care. They snidely wondered if these two artists were creeping back toward the salon, if this signaled the end of impressionism. Also exhibited in 1882 was the exceptionally peculiar Boulevard Scene from Above, among Caillebotte's most radical paintings, which shifted so dramatically in effect from Game of Bézique that most critics were baffled. Here the painter's eye looks almost straight down from his balcony to the pavement through the branches of a ginkgo tree. Passers-by and a standing cab, and you can just barely make it out here through the trees. Here's the horse, and here's the cab, and these figures are seen from directly on top, a bench and a grate. All of them dramatically foreshortened, almost to the point of being illegible. The grate at the trunk of the tree, the double-sided bench beside it, both conventionally seen in elevation, take on unaccustomed, almost abstract forms. Not exhibited, but likely painted at the same time, is this work called The Traffic Island, a brilliantly reductive notation, a true impression of a street shape specifically occasioned by the axes of Haussmann's street plan. Both of these remarkable pictures draw out the visual conundrums of modern Paris, the delineation between pedestrian and vehicular traffic, the strategic placement of street furniture, benches, trees, and street lamps, and the movements of people and animals through this new landscape. They capture a poetic sensibility, one amused by the tension between the controlled, planned environment and the random trajectories of animate beings. Radical points of view also characterize this still life, another painting from that 1882 show, and it garnered quite a bit of attention from critics. Here's a caricature of that picture, and you see scribbled underneath, it basically says a display of fruit seen from a bird's eye view. It is Caillebotte's best known still life, both during his lifetime and since its acquisition in 1979 by the Museum of Fine Arts Boston. Scaled like an 18th century banquet painting, this work celebrates the range and richness of color to be found in an assortment of fresh produce, each fruit type radiant in hue and framed by white borders. This kind of upscale fruitier display could be found in Caillebotte's 9th arrondissement neighborhood. Each piece of fruit has been cleaned and polished and placed carefully in its section, with single examples of larger fruits placed on small squares of white paper set off against like objects for individual attention. The whole tableau is balanced by shape and color, each fruit and therefore each hue its own rectangle, the whole garnished by the deep green of decorative leaves placed across the back edge. The shop merchant apparently capitalized on the seductive color of the fruit to sell his comestible wares. Not an earth tone is to be found. And the painter, impressed by the decorative eye for display of the designer, must admire, by extension, the modern methods of agriculture and transportation that enabled such a varied array of perfectly turned out produce. The counterpoint to the farmer's market stand where fruit spilled out in piles and was bought in bulk by weight, here the client could select single items or several with the assistance of the shop owner. Painted like fruit stand on a large scale, chicken, game birds, and hares makes a striking pendant. And I think that it's kind of interesting. You'll see a few moments in the installation in which this issue of pendants is suggested, pendants meaning two pictures that were conceived as a pair and have a kind of interesting conversation between them. As I'll remind you later, most of Gustav Kaibat's paintings remained with him throughout his life in his apartment and in his home. And so I think he had the opportunity to riff and respond to earlier work or, you know, works at the same time. Although similar strategies in this painting of individuating items while ordering them into genus groups, the goods on view here have not been made quite as decorative. There is, as Kirk Varnadeau described, a rather macabre rhythm to this butcher's display, quote, chillingly mechanical. The bloodless assembly line review of fur, feathers, and plucked raw skin fixed on the horizontal bands of cold marble and metal. As if moving among the shop displays of his market street from greengrocer to butcher, the artist positioned himself as the urban consumer, accepting the motif as it was arranged by other professionals. Still, the unprettified frankness of this tough scene places it within the realist aesthetic of the ugly. In the salaciously detailed descriptions in his 1873 Le Ventre de Paris, which is the belly of Paris, Zola took his readers on lurid visual voyages of the Parisian food industry, reveling in descriptions of previously unrecounted aspects of the central market, Les Halles. Finding beauty in the grotesque was, for both writer and painter, an extension of the realist reaction against idealized forms of art celebrated by the Academy and official arbiters of taste. Stripped of the romantic notions of country and family, of religion and tradition, realist artists and authors sought out mundane motifs as a provocation. The less appropriate a subject was, the more effective it could be. Nothing prepares one, however, for a picture like calf's head and ox tongue. Clearly, Kaibat was attracted to the strange allure of this horrific scene. The coloristic vividness, the clammy texture of dead flesh. Far from the classical composure of traditional kitchen still lifes, of Chardin's popular The Meat Day Meal, which hung at the Louvre, for example, Kaibat's meditation on meat may also have served as a compelling reminder of his own mortality. Quote, "Well, of course we are meat. We are potential carcasses," Francis Bacon would write a century later. "If I go into a butcher's shop, I always think it's surprising that I wasn't there instead of the animal," he writes. In Kaibat's painting, the features of the calf's head are sensitively, even delicately rendered in tones of gray and white, making its piercing by the cold steel hook all the more horrific. Kaibat's fascination extends along the inordinately long shaft of the beef tongue to its muscular base, laboriously extracted from the beast's jaws. In this sumptuously painted, immediately present image, the degree of blood and violence implied by the uprooted tongue and severed head, even if civilized by the industrial methods of the butchery business, cannot be denied. The evocation of pain as a direct vehicle of sensation in art as in life was a strategy that Bacon would also employ to brilliant effect in the 20th century. Striking in their originality and modern aesthetic, Hauntingly prescient of 20th century styles are the series of food items displayed on a white marble table that you'll see upstairs in one gallery. In addition to challenging the artist in textural and coloristic rendering, they're amusing culinary vignettes, their banality elevated by their placement on the white surface under a piercing bright light. Caillebotte's delight in the variety of artfully arranged confections from the pâtissière, from éclairs, financiers, and brioche to the Saint-Honoré cake. That would be this one, which is just a mound of cream surrounded by little balls of pastry, all laden with luxurious icings and whipped cream, carries a quasi-satirical, almost amused sensibility that would resurface in Wayne Thiebaud's paintings of the 1960s. And I'm just showing you, this is the gallery's Cakes by Thiebaud. There are two large-scale nudes in the exhibition, and in fact, they are the only nudes known by the artist, save a rather sketchy version of the male bather. Each astonishing in its own right, the paintings are even more provocative as pendants. Nude on a Couch, on the left, was not exhibited during Caillebotte's lifetime and indeed not known to the public until its acquisition by the Minneapolis Institute of Arts in 1967. Man at His Bath was exhibited in Brussels in 1888 with the avant-garde group called Les Vins, but it was apparently secreted in a back room during the show. It was not seen again in public until the 1994-95 Caillebotte exhibition in Chicago and Paris. And then it was on loan for many years to the National Gallery in London before its acquisition by the Museum of Fine Arts Boston in 2011. In Nude on a Couch, Caillebotte took the hallowed subject of the female reclining nude, a genre in which artists could display their skill not only in tackling the human body and that most difficult of motifs, human flesh, but also in conjuring for their viewer a more or less subtle erotic charge. Henri Gervex's Rola, rejected by the Salon of 1878 and then exhibited in a private gallery, was perhaps the most sensational Parisian nude painting during the years when Caillebotte was conceiving his painting. It provides an overt example of the genre that Caillebotte sought to deconstruct. On a scale just larger than Caillebotte's nude, Gervex offers for the viewer's delectation the radiant, plump flesh of the seductive prostitute Marion, who stretches out with abandon on a clean, plush, unmade bed, taunting the young Rola, who stands there at the window, with her beauty and inviting him to ravish her. In the critical response to the painting, much was made of the inclusion of her frilly satin undergarments and that most erotic signifier, her corset, which you see down there at the right. Caillebotte's picture posits the antithesis, offering an unidealized body that is unenticing in the lean, flaccid forms of the limbs and torso, with pallid flesh marked by her recently discarded mundane clothing. Caillebotte's model lies on a large divan, the same upholstered piece of furniture that you see in other interiors from the bachelor's apartment that Caillebotte shared with his brother. But here, it somehow looks more dingy and dirty. Like her setting, the model's body seems worn. Her pubic hair is shockingly unruly, and her feet bear the imprint of long hours spent in those old boots sitting on the floor at the right. Her hair is neatly coiffed on top of her head, and her short, skinny arms cast her face in shadow while she touches her nipple. Her right leg bends and her foot arches. Far from inviting the voyeur's aroused gaze, she turns into herself, occupied with her own sensations. By contemporary standards, the painting is not only decidedly anti-erotic, but frankly blunt. In Caillebotte's oeuvre, the limp horizontality of the female nude has its counterpoint in Man at His Bath, an exuberant, vertical account of masculine physical vitality. Here, Caillebotte again took a genre traditionally associated with a female figure and replaced her with a male. There are few images of men at their toilette, that is, washing or drying themselves in a private indoor setting. The motif was common by the early 19th century in representations of women, Among Kaibat circles, certainly Renoir and Degas in particular favored such scenes. And I'm just showing you one example from our own collection, a pastel by Degas. In fact, Kaibat owned two such pastels by his friend Degas. This young man of an athletic build has stepped from the tub and, facing the light, vigorously towels himself down. His clean skin glows with the scrubbing. His towel-dried hair fans out like fur from his neck as he flexes his legs and buttocks against the vigor of his motions. Kaibat denies the viewer the frontal view of the bather as he finishes his task. The almost life-size scale of the painting seals its radical provocation. The artist moves into this classical genre, the nude, the female nude, the male nude, detonates two small bombs and then moves on to other genres. There's a wonderful group upstairs of portraits by Kaibat, and here's another genre that the artist enters into and enacts some rather interesting individual sort of innovations and experiments. And I'm just showing you two of those here. The one on the left is a portrait of his friend Richard Gallo, who appears in a handful, maybe six or seven pictures upstairs. And he's sitting in a fauteuil and feels sort of very proximate, very close towards the picture plane. It's a rather intimate, if warily reserved, representation. And then my personal favorite, which is that portrait of Monsieur Eyre. We don't know who this guy is on the right, but it's fantastic how he's almost consumed by the stripes of his sofa as they merge into the damask on the background. It's just a marvelous articulation of this very sophisticated man. Now I'd like to turn to an area of Kaibat's oeuvre that addresses suburban pleasures, pulling us away from the city at the heart of the painter's life and art. Coeval with the urban pictures of the 1870s are landscapes, as I'm showing you here, from the family estate in Hyères, 15 miles south of Paris, which his father, Martial, had acquired in 1860. So the boys had all grown up summering there and going on weekends. The riverside property consisted of a main house called the Casa, or Casino, an extensive meandering garden, and several smaller structures punctuating the property, all conceived by the senior Monsieur Kaibat. Two paintings from 1875 record views of the estate in which space is handled in characteristically idiosyncratic ways to evoke a sense of quiet melancholy. Martial Kaibat had died in the previous year, and visits to the estate were likely still mournful. In Prairie at Hyères, on the left, an expressive, rather anthropomorphic tree in the foreground stretches its tortured branches up toward the sky. The Casa is included far in the distance, like a toy house seen through the wrong end of a telescope. Hyères' effect of rain shows a stretch of the river neatly banked on the estate side, drops of water from the rain-drenched overhanging trees disturbing the placid surface. And in the distance, you see on the other bank an empty beached boat. These images are pervaded by a sense of stillness and absence. The death of Kaibat's father initiated a period of meditation on his own mortality, brought to a head the following year with the death of his younger brother, René, at the age of 26. And at that point, Kaibat sits right down and writes his will, and then reworks it several times. More in line with the pursuit of leisure time pleasure for which the estate was intended is the series of boating pictures from 1877 and 1878, in which Kaibat concentrated on the sport of the canotier. Much like contemporary kayakers, these boaters navigated shallow, single-man skiffs with double-bladed paddles that allowed them to skim the surface of shallow rivers like the Eyre. In the National Gallery painting I'm showing you on the left, and this painting on the right from Milwaukee, three boatmen move in concert, dressed identically in short-sleeved cotton jerseys, blue slacks, and straw hats like uniformed members of a club. Kaibat delighted in the reflective properties of the rippling surface of the water, and particularly in the Milwaukee picture, brilliantly succeeds in recording this challenging motif. His central interest, however, remains the figures and their watercraft. A boating party brings the figure front and center in the composition, making it as much a portrait as a genre picture. The identity of this man is sadly unknown, but his dress in full boulevard fashion, his silk top hat, striped sleeves, and bow tie worn with panache, suggest he has come from Paris. He's a Sunday boater, distinguished from the canotier that is are pictured just there in a rowboat over his shoulder, although his muscled thighs and firm grip suggests an athletic build. His handsome features, blonde, brush-backed hair and neatly shaven beard, square jaw and full lips, and his proximity to the viewer with whom he shares his boat and for whom he rows, cast the picture in the romantic light of the boating genre. Maupassant, among Caillebotte's literary counterparts, and a good friend of Caillebotte's and a boating buddy of Caillebotte's, accounted for the erotics of boating in his 1881 short story, it's called A Day in the Country, describing, quote, the strange feeling of pleasurable self-abandonment that often overcomes a person while gliding over the water in a boat. An avid boatman like Caillebotte, Maupassant depicted the culture of the canotier, these boisterous groups of men playing and joking, half-nude, their bare arms and trunks clad in tight-fitting short-sleeved cotton shirts. A boating party may also have been a response to Manet's boating, painted in 1874, which hung in Manet's studio and was exhibited at the 1879 Salon, the same year that Caillebotte's painting hung at the fourth Impressionist exhibition. The paintings are similar in dimension and format, but where Manet's work suggests only an agreeably familiar interlude for this leisure time couple, Caillebotte's picture is suffused, with desire. As man in his bath, Caillebotte disturbed a heterosexual genre, in this case boating, by supplanting the female with a male object. Scenes of boating, riverscapes, and garden pictures would dominate Caillebotte's oeuvre during the final decade of his life, from the middle of the 1880s to 1894, the year that he dies. In general, as I've suggested, these paintings don't have the tension and provocation of the artist's best works, but there are perhaps a dozen that warrant close attention. The Caillebotte family estate at Hyères was sold in 1879, and Gustave bought his own suburban retreat on the Seine at the location called Petit Genevier in Argenteuil in 1881. He spent increasingly more time at his country estate and moved there full time soon after his brother Martial married in 1887, maintaining at that point only a pied-à-terre in Paris. Echoes of his Parisian life persist, however, in several later paintings like this great picture called Bridge at Argenteuil over the Seine, which I think immediately calls to mind Monet's views of the same bridge, but also harkens back to Caillebotte's Pont de l'Europe. While the palette and brushwork are similar to those found in other Impressionist river scenes, Caillebotte's engagement with the iron structure of the bridge is far more precise than Monet or Renoir would ever register. The original bridge had been destroyed in 1870 during the Franco-Prussian War, and it was immediately rebuilt. Thus, in industrial engineering and reconstruction, it belongs to the same moment as the neighborhoods in Paris that so fascinated the artist. Also within the idiom of 1870s and 80s Impressionist landscape is the series of fields that Caillebotte recorded in 1884. They are unusual, however, in their minimal compositions and in their seriality, corresponding to Monet's series that he started really in the late 1870s, 1876 and 77, and of course, Monet's celebrated series of the 1890s. While Caillebotte employed a vivid, fresh palette and lively touch to record these views, quite likely done on site, in plein air, he seems transfixed by the manufactured nature of this not entirely natural landscape. Indeed, these flat fields were transformed from floodplains to fertile agricultural land using Parisian sewage deposited downstream from the city, like Haussmann's boulevards and places and the modern sewer system his engineers designed to keep the new city clean, these spaces were industrially constructed, irrigated by massive pumps and organized into rectilinear swaths. This nature was man-made. Caillebotte was generally not an inspired landscape painter, even as his colleagues moved decidedly in that direction, making it the arena for the most ambitious, advanced painting for the next several decades. Caillebotte was keenly aware of this development. Indeed, his own personal collection of Impressionist pictures consisted predominantly of landscapes by Monet, Pizarro, Sisley, and Renoir. But Caillebotte's best work was closer to Degas in artistic spirit. And by the way, it's a little distracting. I love this little picture, and you will too when you see it upstairs. It has nothing to do with what I'm talking about right now. I just wanted you to look at something beautiful and interesting and puzzling and poetic while I tell this story about Caillebotte sort of and what happens to him in art historiography. Which is that, I think his aesthetic, his contemporary aesthetic sort of partner and referent was Degas in terms of artistic spirit, both of them mining interior states of mind through unsettling descriptions of the visible surfaces surrounding his figures. He was fully in tune with the complicated tensions of the era, when indeed modernité was fully in force as a psychological and emotional state of mind. His realism, like that of Degas and other academically trained artists, invites and seduces with a reassuring sense of verisimilitude, the buzz of precise transcription, the spark and snap of illusion. But to temper or even contradict the immediate sensation of the real, there is invariably a chilled alteration of space or anatomy or color. The undercurrent of Caillebotte's work is expressive of a sense of isolation. His paintings evoke a struggle to connect to his family members and friends, to people on the street, to the erotic enticement of women. He lost his father at the age of 26, then his younger brother, then his mother, all in the span of 5 years. His economic independence freed him from the need to join a professional community. Though he was dedicated to his work as a painter, that work was not a source of livelihood for him, and thus painting was not, as it was for his colleagues, a job. Perhaps even more socially aberrant, he never married to form his own family, an abnegation of the most basic procreative duty of the male bourgeois during the Third Republic. His life and work exude coolness and detachment, a sense of rupture and distance. A letter to Monet in 1884, part of the small remaining body of documents in Caillebotte's hand, expresses some of the artist's psyche. He'd been reading the letters of Flaubert and noted that the great novelist, quote, wished to show that all the world was foolish, that all sciences, all religions, etc., amounted to nothing. And what an emptiness remains after that. It is absolutely discouraging. Caillebotte continued, I imagine that the very great artists attach you even more to life. This is a rare personal testament to the psychological and emotional context of Caillebotte's paintings, making the dearth of primary documentation of his thoughts and opinions all the more frustrating. When Caillebotte died as a célibataire, his letters and other personal manuscripts were apparently not conserved for posterity. From the few texts that we have, however, as well as from accounts by others, we know that he was an avid reader and an impassioned intellectual. He was classically educated, which is to say that he was trained to read ancient and French literature, and his social set included scholars, writers, editors, and publishers. Caillebotte's work must be understood within this literary milieu, and a discourse of modernity established by Baudelaire and developed by Balzac and Zola, all of whom shared a sense of ambivalence toward progress. The acceleration of change, the advent of new technologies in transportation and communication, and the sheer scale of destruction and reconstruction of the spaces of Paris during the first 3 decades of Caillebotte's life were extraordinarily stimulating and disorienting. Where Manet, some 15 years Caillebotte senior, painted perhaps the most poignant visual responses to this modernité, his lineage from old Parisian stock and his deep ties to old master painting inflect his work with a gravitas, a grounded authority not found in Caillebotte's pictures. There is a shrillness to the younger painter's oeuvre, a tonal dissonance, a bright discomfort, As Robert Rosenblum suggested in the 1970s, Kaibat's eye operated with an aesthetic perhaps more appropriate to the 20th century. It certainly continues to resonate in the 21st. So where has Kaibat been? Clearly a central player in the movement which we've come to determine was the advent of modernist painting, Impressionism. The answers are explained in the catalog, so you might look there. But just sort of very basically, he did, he drifted away, as I suggested, from the avant-garde nexus of Impressionism and those guys and girls in the 1880s. So that by the time he died in 1894, he had basically stopped exhibiting his work. His 1894 memorial exhibition was overshadowed by his bequest that year. So he dies. Durand-Ruel, in fact, has a major retrospective of his work. But at the same time, he's given his extraordinary collection of Impressionism, which was the great private collection of Impressionist paintings, to the French nation. And it causes a scandal because French officials are not quite, they're not quite ready to accept Cézanne and Monet and Renoir in that bulk. And so there's a lot of discussion, and I think his work as an artist was sort of overshadowed by that. Most importantly, he did not sell his work. And so the consistent presentation, sale, and circulation of work that the others were participating, their works going into private collections and then public collections, it's a story brilliantly told in Philadelphia now in an exhibition that opened last week. In London, it was called Inventing Impressionism, the new painting and Paul Durand-Ruel. In Philadelphia, it's Discovering Impressionism. It's about the role of this dealer, Durand-Ruel, in basically creating the movement. But Kaibat, having exhibitions for sale of these artists were crucial, starting in about 1883, really sort of lucratively, and then across that decade. It is a game in which Kaibat does not participate. And we're going to continue this story in September, curators from Philadelphia and the curators here, because it's very interesting in terms of art historiography. So when he dies in 1894, his pictures are all with him still, for the most part, and they remain in his family. There is not a market for Kaibat, and they pass down through descendants of his brother really until the middle of the 20th century, and then they start to sort of burble up, and there is a brilliant chronology in the catalog that Caroline Shields worked on, in which is fascinating, and it's about the moments in which these pictures, you know, came to light, with whom, what locations, which pictures, where they get placed. And I think, you know, most importantly, there is no place to go if you're interested in Kaibat to see his work in any depth. So the Musée d'Orsay has four paintings by Kaibat, and they don't even show all of them all the time. But if you think about the numbers of Monets and Renoirs and Cézannes and Manets that they have there, only four, there are very few Kaibats in any other European museums. The Waldorf-Richards has two. And then in the United States, the Metropolitan Museum of Art does not have a painting by Kaibat. The Philadelphia Museum of Art, as far as I know, does not have a painting by Kaibat. We have one that Paul Mellon bought in 1966, the boating picture that I showed you, not the most important painting by Kaibat. Chicago has two, and I showed you both of them spectacularly. Boston has two. And then you can find single examples mostly in Midwestern museums. So this exhibition is a fantastic opportunity to really try and get a handle on this guy. And I won't tarry you 1 minute more. Let's all go up to the galleries and look at the show. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.